If you were at the game last Friday night, it was Military Appreciation Night, D&D night, and they put up the jerseys from that, all the game-worn jerseys up for auction. And Nikolai Ehlers' number 24 jersey, so far the bidding is in at $800. Number 19's Ryan Falkenham at $650. And Zach Ficalli's number 31, so far, has garnered bids of $1,250. Big game coming up tomorrow night. It's the Screaming Eagles in town, and we gave away tickets to that today. Congratulations to our ticket winner. Let's see. That was Glenn Rose from Eastern Passage. Sheldon McLeod with you here at 7 minutes after 5 o'clock on a Thursday as we look forward to a big day tomorrow. Friday. Like it. We'll have our open phones again between 4 and 5. Invite you to that. Got a whole great lineup of people already scheduled to talk to you tomorrow here on the radio. Well, you know what? Tonight, as the darkness falls, the lights are about to go on. Halifax City Hall is lighting up for what? Crohn's and Colitis Awareness Month. Didn't know that, did you? Shannon Stevenson joins us on the line here, and Shannon is going to give us a little information about what the event is. Hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm good.
Going to be a big night tonight. 7 o'clock is when the lights will go on?
Yeah, I think the lights are going to be on as soon as it's dark.
Okay.
But we're all going to meet down there at 7 o'clock just to meet with a few little bit of the media and take a big picture right in front of the building all lit up. Because it's kind of exciting to have the awareness happening.
Absolutely. So. I've heard of governments declaring it officially known as Crohn's and Colitis Awareness Month. And, you know, it's a little different, though, where they're actually putting up the lights. Tell me about how this all happened.
Yeah, well, our coordinator, Angela Akpan, she actually organized it with HRM. And so in the legislature the other day, they actually read a resolution kind of naming it Crohn's and Colitis Awareness Month, and Halifax has really gotten on board, and so we're really excited just for this opportunity to kind of spread the word and make the awareness campaign known.
All right, so what is Crohn's and Colitis? We need to make people aware.
Yeah, Crohn's and Colitis, it's inflammatory bowel disease, so they're kind of hidden diseases that people don't always talk about as much because they tend to be associated with going to the bathroom a lot. So people don't tend to talk about it as much, but currently 1 in 150 Canadians has it. So it's becoming more and more prevalent, and more kids are being diagnosed as well.
Do we know where it comes from, how it happens, what it's all about?
We don't, and that's what this whole campaign is about, is kind of raising money to fund the research that really desperately needs to be done, because Canada just kind of has an epidemic happening of more and more people being diagnosed.
I see a hashtag here, make it stop for life.
Yeah.
Trying to raise awareness?
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, it's definitely, that's the campaign, make it stop for life. They just really want to get rid of the pain and the stigma and everything that's associated with Crohn's and colitis.
So you are the ambassador. How did they give you that title, and do you get a crown?
I wish. I'm a volunteer with the Halifax chapter of Crohn's and Colitis Canada, and they approached me to ask me if I wanted to help out this way, and having Crohn's disease myself, I was really excited by it, and so I hopped on board.
So when were you diagnosed?
I was diagnosed about 6 years ago when I was in university and in the middle of planning my wedding, so a lot of stress.
So is that what you kind of attributed to first, was, you know, the stress of school and the stress of the wedding?
Yeah, and like moving away from home and eating differently. I just thought, oh, maybe I was having food allergies or different things, but it kept getting sicker and sicker, and eventually went to the doctor and did a bunch of months of testing and came out with Crohn's disease. So
is it treatable?
There's no cure. That's what the research is really going towards, but there are some treatments that work for some people. Like I go and get an IV treatment every 8 weeks to kind of keep my body in remission and kind of make everyday life kind of make it more functional.
So how has this diagnosis, how has this affected your life?
It changes a lot. I remember when I would have flares all the time, you constantly kind of need to know where a bathroom is. You're constantly worried about how your body's going to react to certain foods. You just, there's a lot of unknown and fear associated with it. But I find now I'm meeting a lot of people who know people who have it and are just looking for support and for people to become more aware of it. So it's starting to be a good thing because I'm meeting and doing a lot more things that I wouldn't have done before.
We're here this afternoon. We're speaking with Shannon Stevenson. She is the ambassador as the City Hall is lighting up for Crohn's and colitis. And so the red lights are going to be lit. And how long will they be on at City Hall?
I think it's just for today. Mm-hmm. We're going to be down there probably from about 7 to 7:30 to just take pictures and do social media and stuff. So whoever wants to come down and join, feel free. And it should be a good time.
All right. Well, thank you for updating this and, you know, some of the statistics here. One in 150 people have Crohn's or colitis. It's certainly, not a pleasant situation. Hopefully a cure is not far behind.
Yeah, that's what we're hoping for.
All right. Well, thank you. And, smile big and bright for the picture.
All right. Thanks, Sheldon.
All right. All the best.
Bye.
That's Ambassador Shannon Stevenson talking about this event coming up here tonight. Make it stop for life. Crohn's and colitis, Canada. 200,000 Canadians currently living with this condition. All I can imagine when she was talking about the urgency part is sitting in traffic. Can't imagine that feeling. Ugh. All right, 5:14, almost 5:14. I'm going to take a break here, and in just a few moments, we're going to pick up the discussion about the Association of Nova Scotia Villages. There's a review underway right now across the province looking at municipalities. Some, as you know, are struggling financially because of migration and declining population, and you name it. There are umpteen reasons for challenge. And one group is saying perhaps now is the time to dissolve all the villages. We'll find out what that's all about in just a few moments. Stick around. At 4:48, yes, the Youth Criminal Justice Act, Canada's law that applies to youth between the ages of 12 and 17 who have come into conflict with the law, and all kinds of information on the Department of Justice website if you want to follow along. It's 902-405-6000 1-877-801-8255 if you'd like to weigh in on what you're hearing here this afternoon. Nora, you wanted to make a comment.
Hi.
I'm
one of these strong believers that if no matter what age a person is, if they can commit a crime, we should know who they are.
You know, in some U.S. states, they do that. And, you know, for me, it comes back to part of the conversation we had last week about if you've been convicted numerous times for drinking and driving, and then, you know, you quit drinking, you change your life around, should you get the option to redeem yourself or at least get your license back? If you're 16, if you're 15, you're 14 years old and you break the law, should that necessarily hurt you and follow you for the rest of your life?
Yeah, but obviously, like, they're old, like, okay, they're young, but they know what they're doing.
No doubt. Just like, you know, yeah, it's a, you know, it should be simple. It should be simple. You break the law, you do the time, you know.
And we should know about it, I think, but I'm a strong believer in that.
Yeah, well, let's be clear, Nora, there are people who know the names of the people involved. And, you know, beyond that, the general population, does it really matter to you? I guess that's the question.
Okay. But, oh, yeah. And by your sports thing, I kind of wish you had some sports on, but I'll still listen.
All right. Well,
it's your show, so you can do what you want. Right?
Well, maybe we'll get you on doing sports. How's that sound, Nora?
No, I'm too shy.
Yeah. Well, not too shy. That's not true. Thanks for your call, Nora.
Okay,
appreciate
thanks.
It.
Bye.
All right. It's coming up at 10 to 5 here this afternoon. And Winston, you wanted to talk about the guy who impersonated a soldier.
Yes. I was in the military 30 years, and I just retired there on January the 20th. And by retiring and not being able to wear my uniform, on November the 11th. That was very hard for me. You know, I let my hair grow, and I got kind of a beard now. But just seeing guys in uniform, and I wore my medals, and just not being able to wear my uniform, it bothered me a lot. And to see someone in there, they don't know the whole facts. They don't know if he was in uniform once before, and he wore his uniform, so...
Yeah, I see what you're saying, but they're going back, and some of the medals he had on, there was, you know, it wasn't hard to check to see that there was no way anyone with, you know, that insignia would have been in that unit at that time to receive that medal. Called into question, you know, his dress wasn't quite accurate. There were inconsistencies. A lot of things pointed to him not being a soldier.
Yeah, well, you know, I was just thinking of on my side of it there that, you know, I would have loved to wear the uniform on November the 11th, you know, and I still have my uniform hanging in my closet. It was dry cleaned at the end of my 30 years in the military. The last day I got it dry cleaned, and it's hanging in the closet now.
Yeah, you know, and that's a tough one. I can see why people like you, someone who's done his service and retired, you know, and was discharged with honors. Absolutely. I don't know why the rule exists. Maybe somebody can explain that to me.
Yeah.
All right, Winston, thank you for your service. Okay. Thank you for your call.
Thank you. Bye.
All right, all the best. 902-405-6000. We got a few minutes left, and Dave, we wanted to go to you. You had a comment about young offenders.
Hi, is it me? I'm on?
Yep, you're up.
Yeah, Young Offenders Act, yeah, I think it's a joke, Sheldon. I think if you want to revamp it, take it down to the age of 10. People that are 10 years of age or older know the difference from right and wrong. And if a kid under 10 does something, you hold their parents responsible. Because if not, if the kids are doing something, the parents should know where they're at.
You know, there's a good case to be made there, Dave. You know, but I'll go back to, did you ever do anything stupid?
All the time. And if I had you know what, if I had to get caught for it, I deserve what was coming to me.
I guess the question is, do you think that if you did something stupid, and I'm not talking about what happened today in court, talking, you know, you can be charged under the Youth Criminal Justice Act for a whole lot of things that are just plain stupid, and the only person you're harming is yourself. And again, not talking about the case today. So if should that provision be there to at least give you some, at least the comfort to know that the stupid mistake you made when you were 13 years old isn't going to follow you for the rest of your life.
No, in a way, yes, I agree with you. Stupid, the misdemeanors and stuff like that. But when you commit a criminal offense, yeah, it should follow you for the rest of your life.
All right. That's my
thinking. Mm-hmm. Right. If you go and murder somebody as a 13-year-old,
yep.
For lack of better terms, you're damn right I wanted to follow them for the rest of their life.
Yeah, no question, and that's why I say, you know, that's where we get into the gray area, and we're talking about the gray area, then it's a lot harder to have a strong opinion on it.
Yeah, well, I agree with you, but it's very, very frustrating. I can imagine what the numerous cases out there that what people on the victim side of things are going through, and the frustration they may have, because I'm one of the lucky ones that's never happened to me or my family, so I don't know exactly what they're going through, and I'm frustrated.
Yep. No, I hear you, man.
Thanks, Paul.
All right, Dave.
Hey, good night.
All right, cheers. All the best. Almost 4:55. We got to take a break for the news coming up in just a few minutes, but I got a few seconds here, and I wanted to, you know, say, seeing a lot of comments online today about what had happened, where, you know, somebody was pleaded guilty. Now, there is another person still awaiting charges or still awaiting trial on the same charges from that today we saw sentencing. I can't name the person involved. I can't name the victim. But when people are tweeting about rape culture, they're talking about, you know, a lot of victim blaming. This story has so many different layers. And was it a tragedy for the girl? Without question. It's a tragedy for family. Absolutely. Our lives now affected. Our lives over. Absolutely. The conviction today was based on the charge that was brought before the courts. And that charge was for making child pornography, to which he admitted to. And at the end of today, yes, a conditional discharge for that charge is all the judge could lay, or all the judge could lay or pass down. Now we have the public discussion. And unfortunately for most of us, it won't happen on the radio because of the protection of names. And talking about vague stories on the radio, that's not quite engaging, not terribly engaging. But he's off. Yes, he's off to, you know, the rest of his life knowing what he had done. And there were statements made in court today. And, you know, I'm sure the coverage that you're going to hear will reflect some of that. And the anger will continue, and no doubt in this case, for a long time to come. We've got to take a break for our newscast at the top of the hour. And right now, though, it is our business report.
Big tech news today. First off, BlackBerry teaming up with its direct competitor, Samsung, to provide mobile security technology for the Android operating system. This is BlackBerry tries to reposition itself now as a provider of mobile software and services. BlackBerry CEO John Chen quoted as saying today that, quote, we're not about phones at this time. We're really focusing on the software side. Under this new agreement with Samsung, BlackBerry will offer a security solution for Android smartphones, bringing together Samsung's Galaxy phones and BlackBerry's enterprise service infrastructure. BlackBerry's in the middle of a turnaround plan, scaling back on the size of the company while refocusing its priorities on corporate clients. BlackBerry stock surging. It's up $1.38 right now in Toronto, $14.15. Meantime, stateside, Twitter stock selling off, down 5.1% and falling $40.39. Just in, Standard & Poor's assigning a junk rating to Twitter's debt, saying the company had a fair risk profile. S&P's rating of BB negative is three notches below investment grade. The crown jewel of the tech space, though, does remain Apple, and Apple stock is hitting a fresh all-time high as we speak. It's up $1.67, $112.92 per share. The TSX down 89 points right now at 14,766 as crude drops below $75 for the first time in 4 years. It's down $2.46 at $74.26 per barrel on signs that OPEC is unwilling to reduce output despite a glut of crude. The Dow is up 30 points. The NASDAQ is up 2. The Looney at 87.93 U.S. At the Business Center, I'm Richard Southern.
This is the Sheldon McLeod Show on News 95.7. Now, here's Sheldon.
Yeah, just an update. Highway 102, as the police say, the by-high in the area of Kearney Lake Road, very slow. Deer was hit both sides of the highway, and they're saying that's a mess of car parts, both sides. And they say another 30 minutes or so about... saying it's going to be kind of a mess for a while there. Stay right there. Stay tuned for that. Right now on our program, I want to introduce to you the Minister of Health, the Honorable Leo Glavine. Good day, sir.
Good day, Sheldon. Pleased to join your show.
Thanks for your patience. As a member of the government, you folks are working towards wrapping up the fall session of the legislature. And how late tonight do you suspect you'll be
going? Well, I'm anticipating going until at least 8:30 tonight, and that will put 20 hours in Committee of the Whole on Bill 60, which is the e-cigarette and flavored tobacco legislation.
And will that, you say that's in committee right now?
Yes, that's in Committee of the Whole, and it certainly will go its distance of 20 hours.
Okay. Yeah. Wanted to speak with you about another issue, speaking here this afternoon with the Health Minister, Leo Glavine, talking about the organ donation bill. Apparently, a number of years ago, this had passed, but it had never been proclaimed into law. It's kind of surprising. It's taken 4 years.
Well, exactly, Sheldon. You know, this is one of the areas that, you know, we've tried to actually so far since entering government is to put a date in which legislation will be proclaimed, which we said our tobacco bill will be proclaimed on May the 31st. This one is now 4 years, the organ donation bill, which would deal with a troublesome area around consent. And that being that if somebody has signed their organ donor card to give the gift of life, no family member would be able to step in and change that decision that had been made. It doesn't happen often, but it has happened. Does happen where a family member will say, "No, we are not donating our loved one's organs."
Wanted to ask you, Minister, you know, in many cases, we've tried to educate the medical profession. They know the urgency of having donor organs and donor tissue. Doctors, nurses, that staff knows, and family members, they're obviously going through a very difficult time. And,
yes.
You know, are we talking about criminal penalties for someone who tries, or how will that process play?
No, it will simply mean that, you know, now the legislation, the law, if you wish, of Nova Scotia is that somebody who has signed their health card indicating that they're prepared to donate organs and tissue for transplant. And, you know, we have an outstanding program at the QE2, both from the area of the Legacy for Life, the harvesting of organs, the encouragement of Nova Scotians, who certainly lead not just Atlantic Canada, but Canada in terms of signing our organ donor cards, as well as then having in place for, again, you know, a very, very successful transplant program. So it's, again, another way of facilitating and of supporting, you know, transplant and giving somebody else the gift of life. At a recent Atlantic summit, there was that, you know, discussion around the fact that our neighboring provinces do not sign their organ donor cards to the extent that we do here in Nova Scotia. So, again, that education piece needs to continue forward.
Yeah, I'm sure the uptake here in Nova Scotia is quite high. You know, my MSI renewal came in the mail quite literally this week, and
yes.
You know, I signed, and on the bottom it says, "Do you want to donate some or all?" I clicked all, or I shouldn't say click.
Yes.
put my pen to paper and faxed it off. And so I guess what you're saying then is there may be a opportunity to educate people about doing so, but there's also going to have to be some sensitivity when it comes to enforcing those people's wishes.
Yes, you know, and that is, you know, one of those difficult areas that many times it is in that that time of, you know, trauma and most likely immediate loss. So it is that very, very difficult, you know, period for families to deal with. And yes, the you know, and I believe we do have to send that message that if I like you, and I applaud you for you know, going through that actual decision to donate, and that's another part of this whole business with presumed consent having been in the mix for a while. But we will have to educate Nova Scotians that, you know, a person, and I've recently met someone who was discussing this with a teenage son and what it would mean, and, you know, and I think that education piece is critically important, but, you know, consent, if I'm going to sign, needs to mean consent.
Health Minister Leo Glavine, wanted to, just before we move away from your department in this issue, you had mentioned about Bill 60 and the discussion, and some folks have characterized this as the health department giving in and the government giving in, and some people have said that it's the government listening to the people who showed up at law amendments. How did you classify or characterize this?
Well, look, you know, thank you for offering me a chance to explain here. There's you know, a momentary pause, if you wish, but by May 31st, the province of Nova Scotia could very well be the first to regulate e-cigarettes ban hookah from water pipe from establishments, and ban flavored tobacco. We will listen to the opposition, who wanted to also, of course, include menthol, which is a flavor. We ran into some trouble by giving the e-cigarette and e-juice the same categorization as tobacco. Which means, in order to get that in the Smoke-Free Places Act, the Tobacco Access Act, but it also then, when it came to law amendments, we had heard from a number of people that said that, yes, there is flavored tobacco juice as part of the e-cigarette, but for them, working to reduce smoking and hopefully eventually quit smoking, moving away from the flavor of tobacco was an important step. But yet, in our legislation, we were now banning flavored tobacco, which would include the flavored e-juices. I mean, we have to look at flavored e-juices and those, kiddie candy type of flavors, whether they're in the tobacco or the e-juice. That's the area that was not going to be quickly resolved. It will take us a little bit of work to finalize that. We also saw where the federal government, when they went to ban flavored cigarillos and small cigars, big tobacco moved around them. And we want to make sure we have no loopholes. We protect our youth in the strongest fashion possible, and flavored tobacco after May 1st will not be on the shelves in Nova Scotia.
Fair enough. Apparently you're off to City Hall at some point tonight to stand in front of the Red Building.
Well, look, I'm hoping to be able to duck out of Province House. It's a very fluid situation now with the bill there, and I've been listening very intently, to all of the presenters, and one of the positives that I said today is that it's given every member of the legislature an opportunity to speak about moving to a culture where smoking is not in any way the norm in our province, that we're on a path for further reduction. So that's a positive, and in the end, we'll have the desired bill without any possibility of big tobacco finding ways to get in through a loophole.
Health Minister Glavin, thank you for taking a few seconds out of your day.
Okay, good, Sheldon. Thank you.
All the best.
Bye-bye now.
Health Minister Leo Glavin here on the show, Kings West MLA, member of the government. And as he says, this is about closing loopholes. It's not giving in. And we had a lot of people on this program, quite a few of you, in fact, who said, we're upset that they lumped in the e-juice with the flavored tobacco. And it sounds like they recognize that. So is that a government listening to you? Sounds like he wants to be pretty clear about this, although it's going to be delayed. Delayed but not denied, hey? 5:45, we've got to take a break. And coming up in just a few moments, we're going to hear from members of the Dalhousie Student Union. They want more input. They'd also like to see tuitions lower. We'll talk about that coming up. And highway's open. Just got word from police that Highway 102 back open after that incident involving the deer and the parts of cars and deer. And joining us here, it's an issue that prompted them to send out a news release. Students calling for meaningful input and tuition fee reductions here. The Dalhousie Student Union sent that out. And joining us here, first of all, is Amr Al-Kassab of the International Student Representative. And as well, we have Jacqueline Skiptunis. And Jacqueline is Vice President Academic and External of the Dal Student Union. Good evening to you both.
Good evening.
Oh, sorry, Jacqueline. I think I just lost Amr. We're going to have to try and get him back. Sorry about that. This is my bad. So just while we're waiting for my producer to fix my mistake, you folks are asking for input. Input into what?
Is it? Sorry, it's just me on the line.
Yeah.
Okay. We're asking for, when we said meaningful consultation, meaningful input, what we're talking about is having students involved in the MOU negotiation process and having a transparent, thorough, and legitimate consultation process.
Okay. I'm going to get Amr back here. Sorry about that, Amr. I apologize for that.
That's okay.
So, Amr, you're with you're the international student representative. We were just hearing from Jacqueline about being, you know, asking for input, having some input on decisions, and we're again talking about the memorandum of understanding. Correct?
Yes, we are.
Okay, so we've heard concern from student groups saying that, you know, they were promised they'd have a voice at the table, and that hasn't necessarily happened. But we also heard from some other student groups that say they're okay with a change in process. What is it that has you folks, obviously asking for the input?
Well, our problem initially is that the MOU, just like the procedure itself, does not include the students because we are a huge stakeholder when it comes to this issue. And as students, our problem is not the MOU process or the fee hikes or the whole process. Our only problem is that we see there is a pattern of marginalizing higher education in the province. And this has led us to the situation where we are right now, the MOU. So our concern is that we feel that the government does not really put higher education as a priority. And this is why we are consistent right now.
And you agree, Jacqueline?
To the initial question, I would say that what we're looking for, again, is just being included in the process around the MOU negotiations. We would prefer to see our tuition reduced. We'd prefer not to see it skyrocket. And everything else that Amr said is pretty accurate.
Yeah. You know, obviously, it costs a lot of money to go to university. It costs a lot for students to get a degree. And, you know, we'd all like to see, I shouldn't say we all, I'm a parent of students, and yeah, it'd be nice if we could lower tuition. But what about to balance that, you know, there are costs involved. We have a number of universities and institutions in our province, and there's only so much money to go around.
Right. I think the response to that is that firstly, if there's a deficit in the budget, we've been seeing that deficit seems to be covered by tuition, specifically by international differential fees, and that doesn't quite seem right. I don't think it should be the job of students to make up for a government deficit. The government should be able to find money, and I know that sounds like a very airy thing to say, but it shouldn't be on the backs of students, and education should be seen as a public good. It should be seen as an investment and a benefit to the province and not just as an expense.
Amr, you're here as an international student. You pay a different rate than students from Canada or from Nova Scotia, do you not?
We do, actually. We have a flat differential fee. Like, it's almost the double of the regular fees.
Now, you know, obviously there are other countries in the world, I'm thinking Germany specifically, that recently has eliminated all tuition fees. The students in that country can go to university without paying out of pocket. Obviously the taxpayers pick up the difference. Is that a model that you folks would like to see at some point here in Canada?
Personally, I think that the differential fee are inevitable, like we will have to pay, but adopting the philosophy that the international differential fee should cover the deficit in the budget, it's really, really bad. We have a couple of examples here in the province where there are some universities that focused on increasing the enrollment of the international students to cover up for the deficit of the budget of the school. And over time, actually over a very short period of time, probably 3-4 years, the quality of education provided by these universities has dropped significantly, that some of them actually have lost their accreditation internationally. I see that the province is hitting, the whole province is heading towards this direction. We chose Canada because of the language and because of the quality of education provided here. And also, we do our research before we choose a university. We come here because we know that the education here is a priority to the government, to the Canadian government. And we know that the notion of commercializing education is not really prevalent here in Canada. That's why we chose it here. Adopting the model of Germany here, I know that there are a lot of factors that are at play, but our problem is adopting the philosophy of enrolling more international students so that we can cover the budget. You can do that to a certain point, but then after that, the quality of the education will drop. And that's something none of us want to. Not the international students, not the government, not the Canadian students here too as well. So our main issue, like, we do not want to eliminate the differential fee right away. We know that there are a lot of repercussions to that, but we want to put the notion that we should not adopt this philosophy on the table. That's all.
Okay. We only have a few seconds left, and I wanted to ask again. Have you folks written to the government asking for a voice at the table for these negotiations for the MOU? Jacqueline?
Yes. As members of the Post-Secondary Education Coalition in Halifax, we did. We sent out a letter to representatives from all three parties in Nova Scotia requesting that we had sit-down meetings to talk about the MOU negotiation process and about post-secondary education in the province.
And you haven't heard back yet?
No, we have, actually. The letter was sent out about a month ago, and I believe we were granted a meeting with all three parties, if not at least one or two of them.
Right. We're going to have to leave it at that, but we'll pick up this discussion again. Let us know how that meeting goes.
That's great. Thank you very much.
All the best. And thank you again for joining us here on our program. I want to thank both our guests, Amr Al-Kassab, the International Student Representative of the Dalhousie Student Union, and Jacqueline Skiptunis, Vice President, Academic and External of Dalhousie Student Union. Just had a call from someone saying there was a 5-6 car accident on Highway 102 outbound, apparently just past the Sackville exit. Sorry, that's inbound. A 5-6 car accident on the 102 inbound just past the Sackville exit. Keep that in mind. If you can use an alternate route, that'd be the way to do it. Well, Jennifer, you helped me again, as always. Thank you so kindly. You are the best producer in the world, and hands down, appreciate that. And we've got another day, big day for us tomorrow, Friday. Hey, we made it to Friday. And drive safe wherever you're headed. Again, that accident on the 102 outbound. It's time for the business report, isn't it? See you tomorrow, right here.
Big tech news today. First off, BlackBerry teaming up with its direct competitor, Samsung, to provide mobile security technology for the Android operating system. This is BlackBerry tries to reposition itself now as a provider of mobile software and services. BlackBerry CEO John Chen quoted as saying today that, quote, we're not about phones at this time. We're really focusing on the software side. Under this new agreement with Samsung, BlackBerry will offer a security solution for Android smartphones, bringing together Samsung's Galaxy phones and BlackBerry's enterprise service infrastructure. BlackBerry's in the middle of a turnaround plan, scaling back on the size of the company while refocusing its priorities on corporate clients. BlackBerry stock surging. It's up $1.38 right now in Toronto, $14.15. Meantime, stateside, Twitter stock selling off, down 5.1% and falling $40.39. Just in, Standard & Poor's assigning a junk rating to Twitter's debt, saying the company had a fair risk profile. S&P's rating of BB negative is 3 notches below investment grade. The crown jewel of the tech space, though, does remain Apple. And Apple stock is hitting a fresh all-time high as we speak. It's up $1.67, $112.92 per share. The TSX down 89 points right now at 14,766 as crude drops below $75 for the first time in 4 years. It's down $2.46 at $74.26 per barrel on signs that OPEC is unwilling to reduce output despite a glut of crude. The Dow is up 30 points. The NASDAQ is up 2. The Looney at 87.93 cents U.S. At the Business Center, I'm Richard Southern.